It's Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brings together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. With today's guests and the topic for Encounter, here is Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, should the U.S. government provide defensive lethal weapons to Ukraine as a part of an effort to deter further aggression by Russian-backed rebels? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. The Pentagon has long supported providing some lethal aid, but until recently, the White House has signaled little interest in such a move to avoid escalating the confrontation with Russian President Vladimir Putin. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is blaming Russia-backed separatists and the Kremlin for escalating violence in eastern Ukraine, saying that President Putin can make the choices to end this war. Last week, he said that Russia and the separatists were seizing more territory and refusing to participate in serious negotiations. Secretary of State John Kerry accused Russians of crossing the border with, quote, weapons, personnel, and instruments of death, unquote. Most members of Congress on both sides of the aisle are in favor of sending lethal aid to Ukraine, seeing it as the only way to bring President Putin to the negotiating table. Meantime, the Kremlin vociferously denies that there are Russian boots on the ground. They seem to be in possession of a unique, some would call it delusional, set of alternative facts. Talks in Kiev come as NATO unveils details of a plan to bolster its military presence in Eastern Europe in response to the Ukraine crisis. NATO Chief Jens Stoltenberg says it will be the biggest reinforcement of its collective defense since the end of the Cold War. A new rapid reaction force of up to 5,000 troops is expected to be announced, with its lead units able to deploy at 2 days' notice. NATO Chief Stoltenberg said the bloc is responding to aggressive actions from Russia, violating international law and annexing Crimea. Well, for more on the pros and cons of providing lethal assistance to Ukraine and prospects for reaching a political accord between Ukraine and the Russian-backed separatists, we turn to two distinguished analysts. Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer is former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, now a senior fellow in foreign policy at the Brookings Institution. That's a policy group here in Washington. Ambassador Pfeiffer is a retired U.S. diplomat with more than 25 years of experience focusing on U.S. relations with the former Soviet Union and Europe. And William Pomerantz. He is deputy director of the Kennan Institute for Advanced Russian Studies at the Woodrow Wilson Center. That's a think tank also based here in Washington. And William Pomerantz also teaches Russian law at the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to you both.
Glad to be here.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Ambassador Pfeiffer, let me begin with you and welcome to the program. I'd like to ask you just a direct question. Are you in favor or against sending lethal weapons such as anti-tank missiles, small arms, communications equipment that is being discussed by the U.S. Congress and the White House to Ukraine, and why or why not?
Well, yes, I am. I'm a member of a group of eight people. We came out with a report on Monday that talked about this question, and we advocate a significant amount of American military assistance, $1 billion this year. Now, the bulk of that would go to non-lethal military assistance, things like counter-battery radars that would allow the Ukrainians to pinpoint where artillery strikes are coming against them, where rocket strikes originate. And that's responsible for about 70% of Ukrainian casualties. But we also did recommend that there be a change in American policy, which currently allows provision of non-lethal assistance to allow defensive arms, and in particular, light anti-tank weapons. And that was driven by a couple of things. First of all, members of our group went to both NATO headquarters and to Ukraine in January. What we heard was that there has been, in December and January, a significant inflow of Russian armor from Russia into eastern Ukraine. In fact, one NATO officer said, the Russians don't even spend much time trying to hide this anymore. And what we heard in Ukraine was their anti-tank weapons are all at least 20 years old, and about three-quarters of them do not work. So this seemed to be something that the United States could be helpful in filling the gap. Now, I'd make the point, too, that the goal here is very much a political objective. What we're aimed to is to give the Ukrainians the ability to increase the cost of escalation and increase the cost of aggression to Russia. And you've seen the Russians and their separatists violating the ceasefire since September. They control perhaps 500 square kilometers more than they did 5 months ago. But the idea is to raise the costs to the Russians so that the Russians conclude that there has to be a better way, and that better way would be to sit down and then genuinely engage in an effort to find a diplomatic political solution.
Turning to you, William Pomerantz, the same question. Are you in favor or against this sending of lethal weapons so that the Ukrainians can defend themselves against the escalation by the Russian-backed rebels?
Well, I think this is a question that continues to evolve as the situation evolves on the ground. And I commend Ambassador Pfeiffer and his entire group for raising the issue at the time, because it is an issue that cannot be put aside. It is one that I think is in the back of everyone's mind. The issue, I think, as to whether to do it now, and we are, as we're discussing here, talking about the possibility of more political movement and diplomatic negotiations over the upcoming few days. But I think the issue now about whether we pursue this policy raises a lot of risks for the U.S. as well. It's the risk of escalating the crisis, the risk of making it more of a proxy war between the United States and Russia, and the risk of, at this point at least, putting some real distance between the United States and its European allies. So far, the United States has moved in coordination at all times during this crisis, especially when it has decided to push for sanctions and to raise the level of sanctions. I think, based on what the various statements from our European allies, at this point at least, is that they're not willing to provide lethal assistance. And therefore, I think that to do so at this stage would put the United States, as it were, in the lead and at the head of this action. And I think that will also lead to potential increased risk for the United States. There is just the real question as to what will bring Russia to the table. Obviously, everyone is looking now for a diplomatic political solution. The issue now is really, would the United States, by giving increased military assistance and lethal assistance, will that push us towards a diplomatic solution, or from Russia's perspective, make it more difficult?
Well, let me put that question then to Ambassador Pfeiffer, because those are the reasons that the White House presumably has been reluctant to date to provide lethal aid, thinking that they would be playing into the hands of Russia, creating sort of a proxy war situation, the risk of escalation. Why is now critical?
Well, no. First of all, I think we have to acknowledge there is a risk of escalation, and our group seriously considered that. But at the end of the day, we considered that the risks of inaction were greater than the risks of action. And I'd make a couple of additional points. You know, first of all, the Russians are already escalating. They've been escalating in this conflict since last March. What you see going on now in eastern Ukraine is virtual warfare in places like Donetsk and Debaltseve. The second point I would make is that while others have said, yes, Russia may escalate and that they may be able to escalate more than the United States would be able to, I think escalation for the Kremlin poses a dilemma. First of all, dramatic escalation by the Russians would mean making this much more a Russian military conflict as opposed to the fiction that they try to maintain that it's mainly separatists. That causes two problems for the Russians. First of all, it becomes harder for them to continue to hide the fact from the Russian people that Russian soldiers are fighting and dying in eastern Ukraine. I don't think Vladimir Putin cares about dead Russian soldiers, but I do believe he cares very much about the effect of dead Russian soldiers on his opinion poll ratings and his standing with the Russian public. The second point is, if the Russians become overtly involved, that's going to be very visible to the Europeans and will likely tighten up support within Europe for sanctions. The third point I would make is that, yes, I think there are probably some differences between Americans and Europeans on this question. But two points. First of all, Chancellor Merkel on February 2nd, when she was asked about this, said, Germany will not provide military assistance. She did not go on to say, we oppose anybody else doing it. And I think that's an important point. About 3.5 weeks ago, several of my colleagues who wrote this report were at NATO headquarters, and we had a chance to speak to the NATO Secretary General, the American Permanent Representative, and we spoke to representatives of 6 NATO member states and partner states. Nobody there said that if the United States were to provide lethal assistance or defensive weapons, that would cause a big rupture across the Atlantic. And in fact, we had several allies say things that led us to believe that Poland, the Baltic states, Canada, and Britain might even be prepared to provide defensive arms, but they were waiting for the United States to go first.
Well, back to you, William Pomerantz, and I'm going to give you a chance to respond, because certainly Ambassador Pfeiffer is making the point that the risks actually of inaction are more dangerous than those of acting, and that contrary to what you suggest, perhaps the Europeans wouldn't be so opposed to the United States taking the lead in doing this, that they would not necessarily go along themselves, but they're not going to object. How do you respond to that?
Again, this is all trying to read what Russia's intentions will be. And the very difficult part of this entire crisis is trying to figure out what is Vladimir Putin's end game here. So it is trying to look at what might be the thought process within the Kremlin, where it will feel the need to retreat, where it won't retreat from. It is a very difficult game because Vladimir Putin, to date, really hasn't expressed his over-attentions other than to suggest that what he wants is some sort of federal state, which would grant such autonomy to Donetsk and to Luhansk as to really undermine the territorial integrity of Ukraine. So we are all kind of groping to see how we get Vladimir Putin to the table and under what conditions can there actually be a political solution. As for our European allies, there are European allies who are very openly, I think, willing to support the United States. At the same time, one can rattle off 6 or 7 countries that don't even want to have the current level of sanctions maintained against Russia. And they're former East European countries, but also Austria, Cyprus, and so forth. Luxembourg also is supposedly not a great supporter of sanctions. So that one of the results of this most recent action was at least the agreement of the Europeans to extend the sanctions for another 6 months. But once you throw these weapons into the equation, you throw in another variable. And it's true, maybe it doesn't rebound against us, but I think we also have to take into consideration that indeed the support for sanctions is not unanimous within the EU, and that by pursuing this policy, we might find ourselves 4 or 6 months down the road with the Europeans deciding not having a unanimous decision to continue the sanction. And then we're left with a scenario where there potentially are either an end of sanctions or a new sanctions regime in Europe, and the United States maintaining the same level of sanctions, and also now being in the lead in terms of arming Ukraine. Again, I think Putin is hesitant to put his stamp on this adventure as making it a pure Russian adventure. And he has shown that. He hasn't shown a willingness, for example, to annex Donetsk and Luhansk, where he did so quickly for Crimea. But one of the constants of this crisis is that at all stages, Putin has always decided to double down when confronted with a risk, as opposed to finding this diplomatic solution. And that argument cuts both ways. I appreciate that. But in terms of trying to get Vladimir Putin to the negotiating table, there is the risk that far from getting him to the table, the delivery of lethal weapons will give him a political and propaganda weapon by which to up Russia's level of participation.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Castiel. My guests are Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer. He's former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, now a senior fellow in foreign policy at the Brookings Institution, a policy group based here in Washington, and William Pomerantz, from whom you just heard. He's deputy director of the Kennan Institute for Advanced Russian Studies at the Woodrow Wilson Center here in Washington. We're discussing the merits of sending lethal weapons to the Ukrainian military to defend themselves against Russian-backed separatist rebels. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Encounter Online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA and like us on Facebook. And as always, we love to hear from you. Here's a shout-out to Aladeselu Kayode. He's a loyal listener from Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send us an email with your feedback to encounter@voanews.com or leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to you, Ambassador Pfeiffer. And let's look at the effect of financial sanctions on Russia so far. They do not seem to have deterred his behavior, but the economy is certainly suffering. What impact do you think sanctions and the consequences of them for Russians have on Putin's calculations vis-a-vis Ukraine?
Well, first of all, there's no doubt that the economic sanctions are having a significant impact. The Russian central bank said that capital flight from Russia in 2014 amounted to $150 billion. The Russian Ministry of Economy now projects that the Russian economy will contract by almost 5% in 2015. Now, this is not just the impact of sanctions. It's a convergence of the sanctions and the fall in the price of oil. They come together, and then they, in fact, magnify the impact of the other. The Russian central bank has spent billions of dollars in reserves in a failed effort to protect the ruble. The ruble's lost half of its value against the dollar over the past year. So they've had big economic consequences. They have not yet achieved their political goal, which is to get Vladimir Putin to adopt a course aimed at a negotiated political solution in Ukraine. And his immediate response, I think, was predictable. His immediate response was to portray the sanctions as a Western attack upon Russia to try to rally the population. And I think it's probably been successful in the short term. The question is, what happens in the medium to long term? What happens 6 to 12 months from now as the average Russian begins to see his purchasing power decline by some estimates by 10 to 20%? Does that begin to erode support for Putin? And he pays a lot of attention to this. And will that bring him to a change in policy? Now, I think here there's a big question of timing. The European Union adopted sanctions for a year. So a big set of sanctions came on in July and will expire in July of this year, and another set in September. EU policy is that when they apply sanctions, if the conditions are not met, they roll them over automatically. But my guess is that Putin is betting there's a chance that with the diverse views within the European Union on sanctions, that perhaps he can get away, continue his current course, and have the sanctions somehow be eased in July without any change in Russian behavior. So I think it's very important now for the West to signal to the Russians that the sanctions stay on for months and months and months, if necessary, until Russia changes its course. Again, it would be a change in EU policy if, after applying sanctions for a year with a set of demands and those demands were not met, for the European Union then go say, okay, we're not going to continue the sanctions. And I also think a person who has emerged as a real leader of Europe on this is Chancellor Merkel. And she seems to see this very much in terms of principle, the idea that countries in Europe today should not use military force to dismember other countries. And whenever there's been a suggestion in the last 2 months about perhaps easing sanctions, she's been very strong and says, no, there could be no talk of the EU and the West easing economic sanctions until such time as Russia fully implements the terms of the September 5 ceasefire, and Russia's done nothing in that regard.
William Pomerantz, your take on the effect of these sanctions on Russia, even though they have not changed Putin's behavior so far, in time, do you think they may do so, given the reasons that Ambassador Pfeiffer just mentioned?
I think those are all very valid arguments. And yes, the sanctions have definitely had much more bite than people had anticipated. And it's all because I think it's created uncertainty, it enhanced risk for those who had invested in Russia. And all those conditions will continue to be there. In many ways, even if the Europeans end their sanctions, the one thing I'm pretty sure is the United States will not. And if the United States doesn't change its sanctions regime, most of the risks that are associated with investing in the sectors that the U.S. has sanctioned will remain in terms of investing in the energy sector and dealing with the banking sector. So I think that in the unlikely case that there's a change in the European sanctions, the American sanctions will stay in place and will continue to have a major impact on the Russian economy. The only other thing I want to mention is while the Russian economy continues to suffer, the Ukrainian economy also is in absolutely dire circumstances. And the one thing that the Ukrainian economy needs, well, it needs a lot, but it really does need time in which to kind of recover and begin to deal with underlying issues of corruption and rule of law and attracting foreign investment back. One of the problems I think that Ukraine faces right now is that it is conducting a war, it is pursuing very dramatic economic change, and is really dealing with societal change as well. And it's very difficult to pursue all those policies simultaneously. So I think that President Poroshenko, especially after in August and early September, clearly decided that he wanted to try to find some sort of diplomatic compromise so that he can focus on reforming the economy and helping Ukraine make the transition to a more European state. And as long as this war continues, it detracts from any other efforts in which to deal with the other fundamental problems of Ukraine.
That leads me to ask you, Ambassador Pfeiffer, is that precisely one of Vladimir Putin's objectives, to keep Ukraine in a destabilized situation, preventing it from going forward, from fighting corruption, from making these important economic reforms that would allow it to become closer to the West?
Well, I think everything that we've seen to date, going back to February of 2014, suggests that the Russian objective now is destabilization, create instability, create chaos in eastern Ukraine as a means to destabilize the government of President Poroshenko in Kyiv and make his life generally harder. with a view to, one, complicating his effort to implement the association agreement that would draw Ukraine closer to the European Union, but also to address all of those many real reforms that Dr. Pomeranz just went through. I mean, Ukraine really needs to get on with economic reform. They need to do things, and this war makes it harder. I think President Poroshenko desperately would like to find a solution to stop the war so he can focus on these other issues. But the problem is, at this point, we haven't yet seen the Russians ready to engage in a serious way. And it's despite the fact that if you look over the last, say, 8 months, at many points, President Poroshenko has put out ideas that would seem to be responsive to what the Russians have been talking about. He's talked about special status for Donetsk and Luhansk to decentralize, push authority there. He's talked about official status for the Russian language. Poroshenko has said we can have a Ukraine-EU-Russia dialogue to ensure that we can find steps so that as the European Union and Ukraine implement the association agreement, it is not to the detriment of Ukraine-Russia relations. And he's also talked several points in the past, not so much recently, about we can take NATO and we can take it off the table for quite some period of time. The Russians never picked up on those ideas, and they could have picked up on those ideas and, I think, put together a package that would have allowed Russia to say we've met our objectives. The fact that they haven't suggests to me that, you know, they're more interested in creating instability in Ukraine.
William Pomeranz, why do you think the Russians have not picked up on those very sensible ideas on the part of Poroshenko, his attempt to meet the Russians halfway? And why have the Russian-backed separatist rebels, why have they violated this Minsk agreement in September and escalated the violence that we're seeing today and that has prompted some, as we have said, to recommend lethal defensive equipment to the Ukrainian military?
I think Putin has chosen not to pursue these various diplomatic objectives because he realizes on a certain level that if this crisis is to end and Russia gains Crimea, although it's not really recognized by any other state, but loses Ukraine to the West, then Russia has lost this entire engagement. And in many ways, Russia has lost so much already. One really doesn't anticipate what Putin is going to be able to gain from continued involvement in eastern Ukraine other than continued instability. He's helped forge a Ukrainian nation that was much more divided beforehand. He's pushed Ukraine to the West. They've signed the association agreement. And clearly, he's changed the relationship forever between Russia and Ukraine. So I think Putin has gambled and lost on that level. And that's, again, part of the reason why he hasn't been willing to compromise in eastern Ukraine. He does seem to have the upper hand in terms of the military engagements right now in eastern Ukraine. And I think that's part of the reason why the Minsk agreement did not stand, that from the forces in eastern Ukraine, from the separatist perspective, they only had a very small percentage of the actual Donetsk and Luhansk oblasts, and they simply weren't viable as they existed, pursuant to the Minsk agreement. And therefore, because of that, the separatists decided to change the facts on the ground and are pursuing this winter offensive.
Just a quick follow-up. Is it fair to say that without Putin and Russian backing, that these separatists would not have escalated militarily?
I think it's very clear that if Putin and Russia hadn't intervened, the separatists by now probably would have been defeated.
No question about that.
Yeah, they were well on their way to losing in August of 2014 before the Russians intervened with troops and military weapons. So there was no doubt that the separatists were in retreat. And in reality, the separatists have never engaged in local politics to kind of gather support around them and their cause. They are very vulnerable. Although one thing I fear is that indeed if the Ukrainian army goes on the offensive, that's not going to win the hearts and minds of the civilians who are left in eastern Ukraine as well.
But it would be fair to say that if it were left to them, that is the so-called rebels in the east, that they would have perhaps accepted the terms of the Minsk agreement with this enhanced autonomy. And
I think that the government in Kiev was willing to negotiate, has always shown a willingness to increase local powers, local autonomy, allow local regions to levy taxes and gain more revenue and have it be spent in that region. As Ambassador Pfeiffer said, the compromise has always been on the table. The separatists chose not to take it at every turn.
Back to you, Ambassador Pfeiffer. So notwithstanding the denials, almost incredulous on the part of Russia, that they have boots on the ground, that they're sending equipment across the border, they are behind the escalation. That leads us to ask you, we know that German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French President François Hollande have some sort of a peace initiative in hand. They're going to take it to Moscow. It would be based on the territorial integrity of Ukraine. Given Putin's behavior to date, Does it have a chance of success? Yeah.
I do think it's a good thing that they'll be engaging Putin on this directly. And it's a chance to see whether President Putin's calculation has changed. And to some extent, what you may be seeing, and I don't know whether this is by plan or even inadvertently, is sort of a good cop, bad cop. It's not a bad thing for when Merkel and Hollande arrive in Moscow for the Russians to be focused on the fact that the American government is thinking in a very serious way, in a way that they haven't thought about it previously, about additional military assistance, defensive weapons to the Ukrainian military. That allows Merkel and Hollande to say, this is getting serious. We're on the verge of taking a new step that could have huge cost to you and to press for something. The question will be is, do they find Putin prepared to engage in a way that we have not seen him ready to engage over the past year? And if we do get an agreement, we have to bear in mind very much the unfortunate experience of the Minsk ceasefire agreement. If we do get an agreement, are the Russians prepared to implement that agreement, meet the requirements that fall on Russia, and then use their huge influence with the separatists to make sure that the separatists also abide by the agreement?
Well, the last word to you, William Pomerantz, on that question of the potential for negotiations at this point, this good cop, bad cop idea that Ambassador Pfeiffer suggested, the good cops being, of course, the French and the Germans in this case. And do you think some sort of modus operandi can be reached, one that would meet the minimum requirements of Vladimir Putin and those of Ukraine?
As I said earlier, we're just not quite sure what would satisfy Vladimir Putin. And what's pressing against Vladimir Putin is he has to solve this crisis and still have enough money left over to solve his domestic economic crisis. So at some point, he has to make a calculation whether he's going to continue to run the risks in Ukraine or whether he's going to try to find a way out of it so that he can begin to turn to what are very serious economic issues at home. The recession is just about to hit Russia's main street. It hasn't hit it yet.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guest, Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer. He's former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, now a senior fellow in foreign policy at the Brookings Institution, and William Pomerantz, deputy director of the Kennan Institute for Advanced Russian Studies at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Gentlemen, thanks so much for coming in, sharing your terrific insights.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Kelvin Fowler. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.
Encounter on The Voice of America. Encounter on The Voice of America brought together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. Your host was Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.